Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you're listening to Maltin on Movies. And our guest today just drove up in an AMC Gremlin. I was so disappointed, John.
Well, they made me do that because having worked for AMC for so long.
Oh, the other AMC.
Yeah, they make me. It was either that or a Hornet. Okay. So I had to. I picked and I got the Gremlin.
Okay. Well, this is John Hamm.
Hi, guys. And shouldn't it be Maltins on Movies? I mean, there's two of you.
We've been
Maltins?
Asked about that.
Yeah.
I know. That's a.
Is the plural of Maltin? Maltin?
I mean, I think so.
Okay, fine.
When we speak to Oxford.
I'm fine with it. I just wanted to clear it up.
So, are people now accustomed to the fact that you are funny?
I think they're grudgingly accepting of it. I do. You know, it's funny that we're doing this here at Meltdown. I was saying the last time I was in this actual podcast space, the upstairs room at Meltdown was doing Pete Holmes's podcast. And I've been around the comedy community in LA since I got here, really. Yeah. Back in the early 90s when I arrived on the scene, you know, it was when Sarah Silverman and Patton Oswalt and Zach Galifianakis and Paul F. Tompkins and all these guys were getting their starts. Tenacious D was doing shows at Largo that were $5 to get into. And the reason it was kind of the thing I liked doing was because it was inexpensive.
Mm-hmm.
And you could go and you could have a fun night for $10. Mm. And there's still a version of that in LA. I mean, most, you know, it's that Meltdown here at UCB or wherever, you know, wherever you want to go. And it's always just been a thing that I've kind of gravitated towards. And I guess maybe I got a sense of humor sort of via, you know, proximity, I guess. I don't know.
Like a contact high?
A contact high, uh-huh. Exactly. So I've always just enjoyed it. I've had the good fortune to get to know a lot of these guys over the years and gals. And it's never not fun. When you hang out with comics, it's a good time, mm-hmm. generally.
We saw you my dad was on stage with you at the Coronet for Doug Benson's 12 Guests of Christmas. Yeah. And the thing is, you had on this baseball cap and you kind of kept it low. And the theater in general is quite dark. And people kept hearing this voice because you had your mic right up close to you. And people kept saying to me, who is that? Because you were so funny. And you were, I mean, sitting on a stage with comedians, you just were knocking it out and knocking it out and knocking it out.
Well, it's terrifying. I find it terrifying to be funny on demand.
Of course.
The comics don't. That's their stock and trade. Mm-hmm. And they also have a lot more leash to offend or to kind of to do, you know, other things. And that's their bailiwick. So I'm constantly terrified that I'm going to say the wrong thing or take two steps too far into some thing that I think is funny that the greater community will decide nope is not. And but it's still that's the fun part of especially doing shows like Doug's. You know, where it's all live and in the moment and it's really fun. The crowd knows what they're in for, everybody knows what they're doing, and it's just fun. You know, you get, especially on things like 12 Guests, when you have so many people up there. Or there was another show I used to do with Jimmy Pardo where they would do Match Game. I don't know if you ever saw that.
No.
They would do like a live version of the old 70s game show, Match Game, and Pardo would play the host. And it was people like Paul Tompkins and myself and Scott Aukerman. And it was a mixed bag of whoever was in town, really.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But again, you have six people out there kind of free associating, and it's fun. I mean, that's the fun part of it. Again, it's like it makes you... Live performing is the best. I was, in fact, just at SNL two nights ago because Bill Hader, who's a friend of mine, was hosting, and I was back in 8H again, just looking around. You're like, oh my god, this is so fun. Everyone's having such a good time. Everyone's terrified, but everyone's having a great time.
How many times did you host that show?
Thrice. Three times in 2 years, actually. I haven't hosted since 2010, but. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it's not for lack of.
What was the best part? What was the scariest part of doing that? Well, I think you've answered the second.
The best part is being done.
Yeah,
is good nights. That's the best part. And the scariest part is literally right before they push you out the door.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this kind of bizarre epiphany when I was, I think it was during Dress, the first time I hosted. So it's 8 o'clock at night. You're doing a show that no one will see except for the people in the room, but that will be taped for, you know, whatever, for posterity.
So it's the dress rehearsal, but they do run tape on it.
Yeah.
Just to
You know, so everyone, the camera guys get a run at it. Everyone gets a whack at it before it goes out live on air. And it's usually about 20 minutes long. They do a sort of supersized version of the show, extra jokes and update and extra sketches that then get cut for time. And then they pack it all into 90 minutes. So what you don't really realize until you're there about Studio 8H is that it's about the size of this room. It is absolutely tiny because you're on the eighth floor of 30 Rockefeller Center. So it has to exist in that space. And there's 250 people watching but it's all just jammed into the shoebox. So when you prepare to go begin the show, you know, you're coming out of that upstage center door, which looks like, oh, there's probably a huge room back there. No, there's about 2 feet of standing space and a tiny monitor and a stage manager who's pushing you out that door. Mm-hmm. And all you can hear is the music. You can't hear the intro. You can't hear Don Pardo or now Daryl Hammond. You can't hear anything other than the drums. And it is terrifying. Your heart is beating in time of the thing. You've heard the thing that you've heard a million times, that theme song and everything. And there's a woman counting down from 10 and with her hand on her back ready to push you out the door. And I had this kind of strange epiphany where I was just like, I'm going to soil myself, like essentially, like this is terrifying. And then it all kind of washed away and I went, wait a minute, this is 90 minutes of my life. It's a roller coaster ride. It's a 90 minute roller coaster ride. It's not going to go off the tracks. It's not going to be, I'm not going to die. I'm going to have to like put my hands up in the air and ride this roller coaster. Mm-hmm. And it kind of washed over me as this woman is counting down 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And I went, oh, right, it's supposed to be fun. And she pushes me out, and we did the dress, and dress went great. And we changed some things up between dress and air. And it's that's the lesson I learned. I was like, oh, right, it's supposed to be fun. Enjoy it.
Oh, well, see, but that's a wonderful lesson.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful lesson because too many people, I think, get neurotic about something they should be enjoying.
Yeah, well, but you know, I used to teach acting when I was, right after I got out of college, I went back to my old high school and I taught. Mm-hmm. And a big part of my, you know, kind of philosophy or what I was taught anyway from the teachers I had was like, maintain your presence in the moment, enjoy it for whatever it is. You can enjoy the fear, you can enjoy all that stuff, but you have to be present, you have to be aware, and you have to sort of take it in. And that was the thing that finally remembered about my own sort of situation was like, oh, right, yeah, this thing. Mm. Be here now. It's 90 minutes. There's so few people that get to do this. You're incredibly lucky. And then, you know, smile and say thank you at the end.
Mm. Jesse has, I think on first sight, fell in love with the Hammond bubbly.
Oh my God, it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life.
Well, yeah, you
it's
have.
It's one of the funniest things I've
Seth
ever
Myers
seen in my life.
To thank for any and all John Hamm pun related sketches, including John Hamm's John Hamm and, of course, Hammond Bubbly. We had one that got cut because it was so dumb. I think it got cut for dumbness because it was John Hamm's ham radio. There was some ham radio thing. Mm-hmm. And I was like, Seth, what? Like, I think they wanted Rihanna to do something with it. I was like, I can't even work my way through the logic of this pun. So that one got cut. But Hammond Bubbly was a pretty fun one. And I still, if and when I run into Michael, which I have done on several occasions, whether here or in Vancouver, he constantly just laughs. He goes, "You have no idea." Like that, I get more recognition from that than my multiple Grammy award-winning career. You're welcome.
It's because it's one of the funniest things that has ever happened. And folks at home, if you haven't seen it before, Hammond Bubbly from SNL, it is hysterical.
Super dumb.
You could look it up.
It's the thing is, it's not dumb. It's perfect.
Yeah, I did like that one. And it was the fact that we have this kind of hostage relationship somewhere in the sketch that slowly is revealed is is just the right amount of silliness that I think makes it sort of soar.
Well, that people don't know, I think what made that for a lot of people is they don't know how funny Michael Bublé is.
Yeah, he's a really committed guy too. The interesting thing about SNL is that, you know, you get people on there sometimes and you get to discover, you're like, oh, they're a goofball. Mm. How nice is that? Like you have a certain, I was certainly a beneficiary of that. Like people saw Don Draper and thought, well, that's the only way in that I have to knowing this person. He must be this kind of stoic, you know, brooding dude, which couldn't be further from the truth, as you guys know, because you've known me for a little while now. And it's a cool like thing to discover. And I think it really does lend itself to, you know, broadening one's horizon.
It's exciting. It's exciting to see someone do something different. And then, of course, there's the feeling you have of going, oh, now more people are going to know this.
Well, I you hope so. It's the fun thing about being an actor, too, is just like you get to do different stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to just work on a production line, there's better things to do than being an actor. Yeah. If you want to do the same thing over and over again.
Now, when and how did Tina Fey discover that hidden side, then hidden side?
Well, the funny thing about, you know, Mad Men and 30 Rock have these strange parallel existences. Mm-hmm. In fact, we shot our pilots in the same studio, Silver Cup Studios in New York, at the same time. During which, of course, the Sopranos was on its hiatus between its sort of last two seasons. Mm-hmm. So we would go and like sneak around and be like, oh my God, this is like Dr. Melfi's office. And we're sneaking around at all the Sopranos sets because they were still there. And then 30 Rock and Mad Men were kind of doing their own thing. And everyone thought no one's going to watch either one of these shows. Mad Men made its pilot. 30 Rock made its pilot. 30 Rock was picked up because it's on a network kind of immediately. AMC was going through whatever they were going through, trying to figure out where to put us and how to afford us and all this other stuff. And it took us about a year between the pilot and then going to series. So they kind of got out front and started winning awards and started doing things. Then we kind of came out and started winning awards. So we would see each other at award shows. We were like award show buddies. And it was for a while there that Mad Men won Best Drama and 30 Rock won Best Comedy. And so we would kind of be shoved together at the end of the ceremony. And we would all hang out. We were all pals. And I knew McBrayer and Tina a little bit and Adsit and some of those guys, like, I just knew from around the way. And so when I got the chance to host SNL in 2009, I went through – on Wednesdays is when you do the big table read. Mm-hmm. So it's about a 2.5 hour long. You read about 40 sketches. They probably pick 10. And it's really fun. And the first time I hosted, we had such a murderer's row of talent there. It was still Kristen Wiig and Maya Rudolph and Amy Poehler, Fred Armisen, like all these just killers that were really, really obviously pros and had been there a long time. And they're kind of like right at the end of their runs. So we did the read through and it went really great and it was really funny and it was all, again, brand new to me. And I go down to my little dressing room down and on 8 and I'm looking through my stuff and trying to think which sketches are we going to do and what's it going to be. And I'm just super excited. Like, what do I get to take home? Like, how can I do this? And the phone rings. What, like the weird little extension in this little dressing room. And I pick it up and I'm like, hello? Hi, it's Robert Carlock. I'm Tina's partner on 30 Rock. Do you want to be on the show? Because we have a part for you. I'm like, this is a joke.
I do not want to be on the
no,
show.
No, hang up. Throw the phone out the window. No, I was like, sure, yes. And I gather what had happened was Tina and Robert called Lorne after read through and were like, is that guy funny? And Lauren apparently answered in the affirmative, and they were like, okay, well, let's get him on the show. And they made me the dumbest person in the universe on the show.
Oh, but it's so good.
She's delightful. So dumb that he cut his own hand off waving to somebody from a helicopter.
It could happen.
Totally.
It could happen to anybody. And I'm sorry for any of our listeners who have experienced this. Yeah. John Hamm didn't mean it.
Yeah, it wasn't me. Wasn't me.
Endearingly dumb.
Dumb, yes. Yeah. Oh, it The fun part of that was sort of realizing, okay, this is what we're doing. Because I started off as a doctor. I was a doctor with a child on that show and then got so far out on the fringe of lunacy that I kept saying, like, what? Okay, like, I had a hand replacement. They put a murderer's hand on me. I mean, it was so many weird things that ended up happening to that character. But you learn to just lean into that and trust the fact that you're in the hands of probably the best comedy writing duo on the planet at this point. I think if you look back at 30 Rock and now, of course, Kimmy Schmidt, they're just murderers. I mean, they're just, the jokes are so deep and so thick, and they have an amazing staff, and they just hammer at home. It's amazing. It's great to work. It's a great bosses to have. I'll say that.
Mm-hmm. So now I'm going to flip the question. How did they see Don Draper in you when they cast you in that role? Because that is such a fascinating but elusive character.
Well, you know, I remember going through the process of auditioning for February of 2000, I think, let's call it 2005, and it was raining, and I had to drive from my home in Los Feliz all the way to Santa Monica on a Friday. Mm-hmm. So any of you people listening and that are familiar with LA.
Non-Angelinos.
That is a commitment.
It's not good.
Significant commitment.
You don't even do that for your friends.
Yeah. I see people like at home more than I see people on the West Side.
Yes,
like,
absolutely.
That's the thing. So I read the script and I was like, I really like this part, and I think that there's something that I can bring to this. And I go in. It was called a pre-read, because no one knew me. The casting directors were out of New York City, and they didn't know me or my work. And so I had to meet the casting director first, who I met, Kim Misha. It was Beth Bowling and Kim Misha, to whom I owe an incredible debt to this day, and will always give them credit, because she was like, "Holy cow!" Like, you're the first person we're kind of seeing, and you might be the guy. Like, that never happens. And she was visibly sort of on it, like, as was I. I was like, I was really good in those auditions. Brought me back the next day, got to meet Matt. Brought me back the next day, met Alan Taylor, the director.
No, Matt Weiner, the creator.
And then I just kind of kept, I wouldn't go away. And I was smart enough, or at least, you know, sort of experienced enough in this game to go like, oh, this will be fun. Like, I'll get really far, and then they'll give it to a movie star. Except in 2005, TV wasn't what TV is now.
Right.
It was still kind of the redheaded stepchild of movies.
Yeah.
And so a lot of movie stars, I think, just turned it down. Didn't want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and again, I just kind of kept hanging around. And Matt, to his great credit, I was his guy. Hmm. Everybody at the studio, my agents didn't want me to do it. Nobody wanted me except Matt. And Matt is tenacious, and he fought for me.
Wow.
And so he was the guy that saw Don Draper in me. Hmm. I saw it in me, but no one gave a shit what I thought.
Right.
As long as I kept doing good auditions. And I probably auditioned over the course of a month, which is how long it took them to make the decision to choose basically an unknown to lead this show. I probably auditioned 8 times. I probably performed a version of every scene that Don is in the pilot at one point or another. And again, to Matt's great credit, he was like, that's my guy. That's the guy.
Wow.
Period.
Wow.
And it's funny, we had a party, like maybe in between the seventh season where we broke it in half. So we had like a kind of it wasn't a rap party, but it was sort of a pseudo rap party. And it was at Matt's house, and he had a big dinner, and it was really nice. And all the gang was there, and he showed us all our audition tapes. And we were like, whoa, that was, and by the way, everyone killed it. Everyone was great. We were like, oh my God, everyone's great. But you see like Vinnie Kartheiser with crazy long hair and like Lizzie 5 hairstyles ago and, you know, January and some other thing. And it was just, and of course we're all 10 years younger too. And it was just bonkers, but everybody was great. And you're like, oh my God, yeah, you picked the right people. Good job.
Wow.
And that's a wonderful thing to get to share with your...
Oh my gosh, yeah, it was super cool. We were all kind of, we were all definitely sort of pleasantly pleased.
So what is the story of Ham? What did you want to be an actor? Did you want to make movies? Did you not want any of that? Did you like to be funny and entertain people?
I don't know. Like I remember being, my first job wasn't a job. My first time on stage was when I was 5 years old. I played Winnie the Pooh. And I did very well, apparently. I was hand chosen by my first grade teacher, Shirley Kasoy, who said, "I know you're gonna be fine. You are not shy." But I was like I was raised by a single mom. I was the only child, so I spent a lot of time in my own head and a lot of time reading and a lot of time reading comic books and other books and anything I could get a hold of and a lot of time just playing. And so. That's what school was to me, was like, this is an opportunity to kind of take everything in. Again, I guess it's like if you want to say it's a theme in my life, but I've always just been like, oh, these are opportunities. You should take what you can out of them. School for me was absolutely that. Especially losing my mom so early and having kind of that upheaval in your life. What you end up trying to do is really find stability wherever you can. And of course, institutions, that's where we have it, right? So school was that. Athletics was that. Theater was that. And like that part of it was how I kind of, that was my door in, you know, my entryway. And it was one of those things that I just kept getting good feedback, basically. People were like, you're not bad at this. Okay, well, I guess I'll keep doing it. And I enjoyed it. You're kind of on the island of misfit toys. You have this like little gang that you put together, and everybody. It's a very supportive environment. I mean, it's a good group to be involved in, and it's one of the reasons why when I graduated, I also needed a job, but it's one of the reasons why I wanted to go back and teach. I knew I wasn't at that point in my life, obviously, able to like write a big check to the school that I thought really helped me survive, basically, and thrive. But I knew I could give my time. And so I did. And I basically pitched myself. I was like, hey, you know, not for nothing. Like, the theater department got really big because we have this great teacher, and he probably needs some help. And I just graduated. I didn't have a theater degree. I had an English degree, but I was, like, pretty good at what I do. He knows me, and I can take all the... you know, eighth graders and take a couple of classes off of his plate and help out. And they went, okay, cool. And it was the most money I'd ever made in my life, $25,000 per annum. And it was fantastic. And I've a lot of, one of my students I work for, I guess at this point, was Ellie Kemper on Kimmy Schmidt. She was a ninth grader. She was 15, whatever, and was like, I was like, that girl's good. Good. And then all of a sudden, she's on The Office, and then this thing. I was like, yeah, okay, that makes sense.
How long did you teach?
Just a year. Got offered an extension. I got offered another year. But I realized, I was like, well, if I don't go to L.A. or New York, and for me it was always L.A. because I just liked L.A. and I had family out
here. You were in St. Louis at the
I was
time,
in
right?
St. Louis, yeah. And I was like, if I don't do it now, I'm never going to do it. Yeah. And I'm not getting any younger. And I was all of 25. And it was an easy decision for me. It was like, I have a lot of friends in St. Louis that are like, how do you live in L.A.? It's like, like I live on the moon or something. It's like, and it's a city, you know? Yeah. You just literally, you go west, you'll hit it. Yeah. Like, it's not that hard.
Just don't go west during rush hour.
Don't go west during rush hour in the rain on a Friday.
No.
Unless there's a really good job.
That's right. Oh. That's right. So you were on a number of series before Mad Men.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, because I've never asked anybody, I've never had a chance to ask an actor this before. Did you think all of them were going to hit? Did you have high hopes for those ones?
No. And the funny thing was, I was a sort of recurring guest star on Providence, mm-hmm. which was a nominal hit on NBC on Friday nights. It was a family show.
It's
it was like
show.
One of those things. And everyone was sort of, everyone just knew what that was. It wasn't going to win awards. It wasn't going to think, but it was good. And it was a good place to kind of learn how to be on a set and learn how to behave and learn how to manage your time and all that stuff. And for me, again, it was like, it was a great job, but it was a job. You know, it wasn't, I knew it wasn't going to necessarily blow up in a way that obviously something like Mad Men did. And then I did, after that, I did a show called The Division, which was on Lifetime, which again was like perfectly good show, procedural, right down the line. It's sort of, you know, it's sort of thing was that it was five women cops and me. And I was the only dude on the show, which was interesting and totally, again, totally fun. I got to work with some amazing actors, Taraji Henson, who's like huge now, and Bonnie Bedelia, and made, you know, friends for life. Tracy Needham, who played my partner and co-star on the show, is still, we're still good buds. And you take away, that's what you take away. You think, okay, well, whatever. Like that, not everything is going to be the next ER. Not everything is going to be the West Wing. Not everything is going to be Mad Men. Not everything is going to be whatever. But you work and you try to put into it as much as you can. And that's, again, that's the fun part for me. That's the fun part of doing it is, okay, well, let's make this turkey trot. Let's go.
So there's before Mad Men and there's after Mad Men, right, in your life and in your career. And after, you've gotten to do so many interesting things. I mean, you've been on every animated series, I think, on the air, either as yourself or as a character. And you've gotten to do comedy stuff, which you've always enjoyed doing. And you've gotten movie offers, and some of which have taken you around the globe.
Yeah.
Talk about globetrotting.
That stuff is the fun stuff. You know, I've had the good fortune to work in England a lot. I love working over there. And do some fun, weird stuff. We were talking about Travel Man. I got to do that. That took me to Hong Kong. I got to work.
Explain what that is, because it was before we were
Travel Man is an amazing program that I want everybody to look up and find somewhere on the internet. But it's hosted by Richard Ayoade, and he's such a unique voice, to say the least. But he takes a celebrity guest to a city for 48 hours and shows them around. And it's real fun. And I was lucky enough to get to go to Hong Kong, where I'd never really been to, other than India, I'd never been to Asia. I'd never been to Southeast Asia, at least. Southeast Asia? Yeah. And it was a blast. But yeah, I've got to go. I shot Million Dollar Arm in India. That was an amazing experience, like just making movies in India, which obviously has a huge cinematic tradition. And in fact, one of the first days where we were doing camera tests or whatever, we got to visit another set where they were shooting like a massive Indian dance sequence craziness where we're like, no way, like this is really happening. And it was crazy. I mean, it was so fun and cool. And just, again, one of those things you like file away in the memory banks and go like, okay, that happened. And then like a week later or whatever, I had my first day on set, which was on location in Mumbai. And the van stops and it's like, here you are. I was like, where? They're like, right there. I was like, in the middle of the 100,000 people that are going about their day. And they're like, yep, that's it. And it was 100 degrees and it was sweaty and it was amazing. Those are the things you think, okay, well, again, like it feels like a theme, but I think like when you can complain about that stuff or you can just go like, well, this is what it is. And I have to, we have to do it. We're not going to not shoot. Let's go. Let's hitch the wagons up and let's go.
But that it's that kind of attitude that makes people want to work with you and want to have you around and want to cast you in things, because who wants to be around someone miserable?
It is because obviously it is a choice. I mean, everyone has bad days.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say I don't have a bad day, but like
that's human.
It's a choice to make, to remain miserable. You're right. And it's and it's not it's certainly not a fun energy to be around. And it's, again, we get to dress up and act like idiots for money. Like what's to complain?
The commercials that are running on every single station right now. You as a wizard.
So
you
stupid.
They're so funny.
That was a real serendipitous kind of thing that I was like, why does H&R Block want me to be their guy? Like, that's such a weird fit. And then we got, the creative was handled by a small company. Well, not that small, but like a company out of Minneapolis called Fallon. And their creative, I was like, this is hilarious. Yeah, I'll do this. Like, again, why not? Like, it's fun and it's funny and it's specific and it runs for 4 months out of the year. And the people, right about the time people get sick of it, the tax time's over and they're done.
But they are, I mean, they really are productions.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You guys are on a battlefield.
We shot those we shot 10 spots in 4 days. I mean, it's, the pace of commercial production in that sense is crazy. And again, like, if you're not ready to go, if you're not like on board, it's gonna swallow you. Yeah. And so again, I had the best time. I had like my hair and makeup person and like the same kind of director from the first series that we did, and we just all hit the ground running, and it was hilarious and dumb and fun. And you're kind of like, all right, who gets to play? Like one of the first ones I did the previous year, they put your clothes on and like, okay, and here, and now you're in this set. Okay, well, what do I do? Okay, you run down through here, and okay. And then I talk to them, and we just make some stuff up? Yeah, okay, great. And so you get your taxes won, whatever the line is, out, and then it's like, okay, mess around a little bit. And I get through the thing, and I see the other actors who are in the scene with me, the direction was just improv some stuff, like talk to him for a little bit. And I recognized one of the actors. Like, I was like, we went to college together. Like, I haven't seen you in a while. Hi. And it was, and I'm in some dumb outfit and like everything. Like, hi, Melanie, how are you? And it was so, like, it was nice. Like, you're like, oh, right. Like, I do have like a history in this business, and I have known folks for some time, and
sure,
it's always just a pleasure to see, you know, to run into people and see that everyone's working.
Tell me a little about A Young Doctor's Notebook, because I don't know anything about that, and that's the show in which you co-star with Daniel Radcliffe, but actually played the same character.
Yeah,
as Daniel
it was
Radcliffe.
It came about because I had done a few episodes of The Increasingly Poor Decisions of Todd Margaret, which was a David Cross show that they did, shot in England. And it was an absurd kind of role that I played, but I met the production folks over there, and they were like, hey, ever want to do anything over here again? Like, let us know. Okay, cool. And this series of short stories written by Mikhail Bulgakov, I'm never sure which accent to put that on, but he wrote kind of, and he's sort of a fabulist, like his writing, most people know him from Master and Margarita, but his writing kind of reaches into the realm of magical realism sometimes. And he wrote these sort of stories about his experiences as a young doctor in post-Soviet revolutionary Russia. And again, he wasn't in Moscow where everything was happening. He was like way out in the sticks. And obviously, we know Russia's a fairly large country, and a lot of that stuff kind of hadn't reached the sticks yet. So he was sort of reading about all the things happening in Moscow and then having to deal with, like, you know, syphilis in
damn it, syphilis.
In the neighbors here in Nowheresville, out in the sticks. So anyway, it was by nature, it was sort of episodic because there are these short stories. And we thought, well, this could be an interesting way in, at least. And I met Dan Radcliffe somewhere at a an award show or something. And I knew he was a fan of like the weird. And so I was like, okay, I just because he had, I watched what he chose to do. I mean, he's Harry Potter. He could have done anything in the world. And what did he do? He learned how to like tap dance and went and did How to Succeed in Business. Right. And then he went and did Equus. And he was choosing these smaller movie roles. And I was like, okay, I think this guy likes to think out of the box a little bit. And so I pitched him this thing. I was like, you want to play? I said, if anybody knows anything about being buttonholed into one role, I said, we have that in common. But here's a chance to do something weird. You want to do it? Can you do it? He goes, you have no idea how much I love Mikhail Bulgakov. I've gone to his like birth place in Moscow. I was like,
of course you
well,
have.
That's yeah. crazy. Okay. And he said, I'm in. And we got to do two seasons of it, and it was great. And it was, you know, it was a marginal little hit on Sky Arts and in the UK. And it was, again, it was fun. It was an interesting, weird thing. I got to do an English accent, which I'm terrified of doing. But that was, again, that was fun. And off and away, you know. It was a cool thing.
Wow. Has it had exposure here in the States?
I think it's on some streaming platform somewhere, as everything yeah. seems to be these yeah. days. I don't think it was. Oh, it was picked up on a station called like Ovation or something.
Yeah, that's
a small yeah. a small cable outlet. Again, God bless. Like I'm very proud of it. It was a fun thing to do, and in the world in sort of the television landscape which we find ourselves nowadays, there's a space for that. That yeah. like that nine people are gonna dig.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to do that stuff all day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I always ask this question because I wonder if there's anybody that you look at as kind of a role model in the sense not just as an actor, but in the way they handle themselves, the way they've handled their career.
My go-to kind of response to that has always been Jeff Bridges, and an actor who I've just got to work with. I just finished a project, and I had met Jeff again through the swirl of Hollywood a few times, and have enjoyed every single one of his performances, his career, watching it happen where he got crazy famous in the 80s. He was the next big thing, and it kind of didn't sit on him the right way. Like he would do movies like Blown Away or whatever that thing was, where he's the action star. And you're kind of like, I don't think he wants to be that guy. And I don't think he thought that either. I don't want to be this guy. And then kind of having the Renaissance sort of post Lebowski thing that he became, this kind of eminence grease in Hollywood, and having just had the chance to work with him, I was like, oh man, this is the best. Just watching this guy do it. He's a dedicated actor. He's a committed actor, and he again gets it. He doesn't phone a single thing in. And I think anybody at that level of their career, and he's certainly about as top notch as you can get, they must have a version of that diligence and dedication, or they wouldn't last. They'd be sniffed out.
He performed one of the main songs from Crazy Heart at the LA Film Critics Awards a few years ago. Fallen Feels Like Flying, I think something like that. I don't remember the title. I know the song. I love the song. Getting to see him on stage performing guitar and singing and all that, it was so cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool just hanging out with him too. And I kind of fell into this project that we did together last minute. In fact, I was at Sundance, and the project came to me, and they're like, "Well, you need to let us know in 36 hours, and then you need to be on a plane in 48." And I was like, "Oh, okay." And fortunately, it was a great part. It's a great project. And I got up and sure, we're gonna play. Let's go. Gotta go. And I got to meet Jeff, and we sort of were rehearsing some stuff and going back and forth. And I, my aunt and uncle have a house in Montecito. They live up there, as did Jeff. And of course, that got ravaged by not only the fires, but then the mud.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jeff got we're all safe, but a lot of people weren't. And, I mean, Jeff got rescued off his roof.
Yeah.
Helicopter.
Helicopter, yeah.
And I was kind of like, are you okay? Like, what's going on? Like, hey, man, everyone's fine. Lost some livestock, that's the way it goes. And you're like, how are you here? How are you present? And it's an amazing lesson to kind of go, okay, like, this guy is taking that, the good with the bad, and is really, again, staying kind of in the now. He's obviously, he's a big Zen guy, and he understands a lot of that. Mm-hmm. He's a big thinker, which is also really nice, and just a pleasant energy to be around. And it was like, you know, they always say don't meet your heroes, but I was like, in this case, I was like, are you kidding me? I'm so glad I got to meet you. and it was really nice.
Are you home at all?
Yeah.
Do the newspapers pile up on your front doorstep?
What is it? Dated expression.
Sorry
what are
that.
Those?
And the milkman doesn't know that you're home or whatever.
I'm home now for the first time probably, and I'll be home for a couple weeks, and I'm home now for the first time really since the beginning of the year. Mm-hmm. It's which is good.
Yeah.
That means that I'm working.
Sure.
But it's also tricky. I feel like what I love about being home is that I have clean underwear and socks.
Right.
Like that, I'm just the idea of go dipping into the suitcase and you're like, "Oh man, this is not great." Is rough, but it has been, again, like I say, like it's Being away is generally a good thing. It means you're working. But I go back on the road in April to work on a small film in New York, and then the next thing I'm doing actually shoots in LA. So I'm like, what is that like? Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. Like it's I haven't had it in so long.
Yeah.
But it's definitely nice. This will be a nice couple weeks to kind of recharge and play some tennis and get out and hike and get out in the world. It's from Vancouver to New York, where I was shooting the last two things. It was like cold and damp to cold and damper. And it's like, that's, you know, you get back to LA and you're like, oh, right.
This is why people like it
this
here.
This is why
I
moved here.
That's why you moved here in the first place.
It's sunny all the time, even if it's chilly.
It's just
sunny all
nice.
The time. I'm laughing because my husband does lighting for theater and tours for months at a time.
Oh, yeah.
And as soon as you said underwear, his little face just lit up because that is one of the things he's like, so I went and bought new socks today.
Yeah, you do it. You end up buying my underwear and sock drawer is overflowing.
Right.
Just because it's easier to buy new stuff.
The glamorous life.
The glamorous life. Washing your socks in a sink.
He's laughing. It's the same. I'm about to lose him for 5 months. You and I need to hang out.
There we go.
I have no husband for five
we'll
whole
do
months.
It.
You've done a handful of really good movies that just stand out to me. One of them, it was a no secret to anybody, was The Town.
Mm-hmm.
Such a good movie. Such a good part for you.
It's an interesting, that the genesis of that project is actually kind of fascinating. And it's kind of the one time where you're like, oh, good job, Hollywood. Like, you did a good job. Because there was a version of that script. I remember reading it years before it got made. And another director was attached to it. It was a wildly overweight script. Like, it was 100 pages too. Like, it was crazy. I was like, who's going to make this movie? Like, this is a three-hour movie. That's so specific. No one's going to make this movie. It had like a sexual element to it. Like there's all this other stuff. And I was like, and there certain people were attached. And I was like, that guy's going to do it. Like, okay, wow. This movie, huh? And eventually it went away. And this was probably around season two or three of Mad Men. And then it came back and they said, oh, Ben Affleck's going to direct it. And I had just seen Gone Baby Gone in Deauville, France.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that's an interesting choice. that movie was good.
Mm.
It had three too many endings, and it had a, you know, it was a couple, it wasn't perfect, but it was really good.
And, great use of Boston.
Mm. Yeah. And for a first timer, yeah. Really, you're like, holy cow, like that's a steady hand at the tiller.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they said, well, the script's different too. You should really reread it. And I picked it up and I went, well, it's lighter. Mm. It's certainly shorter. And I read it and I was like, oh, he took out all the fat. And made it this really streamlined, really kind of old-fashioned cops and robbers movie. Mm. And I was like, I'll be in this movie. This sounds great. And I got to meet Ben, and he was like, this is what I want to do, and this and that. I want to shoot it like this, and blah, blah, blah. Have you ever seen Friends of Eddie Coyle? I'm like, oh, my God, that movie's amazing. Like, and we were all kind of, Renner was, like, white hot at the time, and we had this great kind of group, and Ben is the patron saint of Boston, for God's
yes.
sake. Like, walking around Boston with him is like walking around with Jesus. And Pete Postlethwaite, his last performance, mm-hmm. the alchemy was perfect. And we did. We got to make a really good movie.
Yep.
And a movie that kind of doesn't get made anymore. Those kind of weird one-off, it wasn't based on a thing. There wasn't going to be a sequel. It was kind of the old, it felt like making movies in the 70s. Like, it was really, really fun. And again, I got to play, you know, what would generally be seen as the good guy. But of course, in Boston, everybody hates the cops. So they were like, you're the worst. Ham.
Ham.
So it was fun. It was a blast. It was a blast.
Well, that's a terrific movie.
It really.
Yeah, you get to, you know, you. Again, like you said, you'd asked about certain things, like, do you know they're going to be successful? I'm like, no, you never know. You never know what's going to hit. Like, I knew I liked The Town. I knew I liked Mad Men. I knew I liked Baby Driver.
Mm-hmm.
You never know. Mm-hmm. I loved Million Dollar Arm, and it got literally squashed by Godzilla at the box office. So, you know, you don't, you can't.
Damn it, Godzilla.
You can't guess. You just hope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's funny, like with a movie like Million Dollar Arm, I have so many people that come and they're like, I watched that with my son, who's 8.
Hmm.
And you're like, that's exactly the right way to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the movie for a dad and his son or daughter or whatever. And they just sit there and they watch it and they go, this is, oh my God, what a nice movie and a nice message.
Yeah.
This is something that we've got to talk to Stephen Chbosky about Wonder.
Mm-hmm.
Steven makes beautiful movies,
mm-hmm.
and it isn't so much about the in-your-face screaming, here's the message, here's what we're doing, and Million Dollar Arm is exactly that, which is that, no, sometimes it's okay if it's just a nice movie, if it's just a good movie. It doesn't have to change the world, doesn't have to reinvent the wheel. It can just be good.
Yeah, and again, you don't know, again, it's such a crowded landscape. And there's so much noise that everybody's banging the same drum to try to get somebody to pay attention.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That sometimes when I feel like, fortunately, like everybody at Disney and Alan Horn had just come, who was running Warner's at the time that we made The Town.
Mm-hmm.
Alan came in to run Disney and was like, we were nervous because we were like, this is like a project from the previous, you know, administration. Generally, those don't
survive
the putsch, so to speak. But Alan was like, this is a perfect movie for Disney. We love this movie. Are you kidding me? It's like, right, that's what we where we want to be. And the movie tested great, and it, you know, again, it's a good film. It just got kind of swallowed up.
But nowadays movies have an indefinite shelf life.
Absolutely.
It's a new world.
Know? Yeah, it's a whole new world.
And it's a new world.
In the best way. I mean, I talked to, not only have we known each other for some time, but I mean, Alan Sepinwall, who's a good friend, who's a wonderful television critic and writer, I was like, it's got to be the greatest combination of exciting and awful to be a TV critic right now, because everything's great. There's so much great.
Yeah.
There's too much great.
Mm.
So I'm like, where do you draw the... Also, like, what's TV?
Yeah.
Where do you stop watch? Like, where do you draw the line of what you watch? Is it YouTube Red? Is it PlayStation?
Yeah.
Is it Twitch? What is it? And it's and he's like, I don't know. Mm. Yeah. I don't know. He goes, I just know I'm exhausted.
Right. Well, is it the, well he doesn't have time for TV. That's the problem always.
I get to watch too little.
Yeah.
And I want to stay in the conversation.
Yes.
You know, I want to be
of course.
In on what is happening
right.
now and in the zeitgeist. But it's hard.
It's so hard. Even
it's not digging a ditch hard. But
No.
It's not lead mining.
No, my mom and I watch everything. And our thing is to sort of like, all right, we've now seen all of the TV shows. Yeah. Here's what we're going to sit you down. You know, it's and that's kind
we'll
of
give
the,
you the distilled version.
Yeah, yeah. Oh my God, I saw this. You have to watch. It's brilliant. And then he does.
So to that end, the one I did most recently was The End of the Fucking World.
Oh, you guys I love see that. That? I loved it.
It's such a specific. It's what I love about you know. It's why I was drawn to a project like Black Mirror. It's why I did Toast of London. It's like there's sometimes there are these little. Things that bubble up to the surface and you're like, oh my God, that's amazing. Where'd that come from? What left field weirdo made that?
Speaking of, no, I was going to say weirdo. That's not what I'm about to say. That's not what I meant to say. We know Edgar Wright and we love Edgar and he is the movie buff's movie buff.
He is a singular talent.
And so what's it like being directed by
him? The best.
Him?
It's you were a baby talk, where you talk about, like I said about Ben, but there's a firm hand on the tiller, and when you walk on set at 6 o'clock in the morning and you look at the shot list that he's got set up and he's already knocked off three of them, and you go, okay, that's what we're doing today. Mm. And it's his brother does his storyboards. He works with the same people. Bill Pope, who was our phenomenal cinematographer on that film, he knows what he wants, and he's excellent at communicating what he needs. And you go, all right, again, like, you couldn't have taken the smile off my face in that movie with a jackhammer. I mean, it was just, I had the best time. Mm. And it's Edgar. I mean, he, you can sit and talk to him about any movie. He's seen all of them.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And he is, like you said, he's the filmmaker's filmmaker. And he's rightfully being lauded as such. I think he was just in England winning the Empire Maker Award or something, some crazy thing.
Yes. And
I couldn't be happier. I've known him for years. I met him the first time through Bill Hader the first time I hosted SNL, the after party. And I was like, I've stumbled into Shaun of the Dead in St. Louis, Missouri, with my best friend from childhood. We were like wanting to see, we were both back for Thanksgiving or something. We're like, let's get the hell away from our family. It's like, what do we do? Like, let's go see a movie. It was a rainy day and cold St. Louis. And I was like, I heard this movie's pretty good. Let's go check it out. Went to the movie theater, I think, that we both saw Star Wars at in 1977 or whatever, and watched Shaun of the Dead. And I was like, who is this guy?
Yeah.
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 Who is this guy?
Yeah. The movie nerddom in my mind of you being with Bill Hader and Edgar, I cannot imagine. Because one of the things that we heard about you long ago was how good you were at the Leonard Maltin game on Doug Loves Movies. Everybody, Sam Levine would always say, oh man, Ham, he's got this. He's got this. Because he's like my adopted brother. I love that boy.
Oh, Sam.
And I talk about him all the time because I love that boy.
He is a sweet boy.
And it's
a full-grown man, by the way.
Oh, yes, well.
Full-grown man. Just
to
tiny.
To me, he's my bebe. And, you know, you kill at that game.
I get very lucky at that game, and I feel like I often am able to kind of game the game in some way that I make other people. I still don't honestly know how that game is played.
It's
the rules are lost on me.
You manage it.
But yes, I do enjoy it. And again, Doug's podcast is so fun because it's right there in the title. He loves movies.
Yeah.
And Doug's another guy. He's like, he sees everything.
Oh, yeah.
Everything.
And it's God bless, you know, that's where you want to be if you're Doug.
And he's so smart.
So smart.
Wildly funny and smart. And again, I've been seeing Doug do stand up since the 90s. So we've known each other for over 20 years and it's funny to kind of be invited onto that show and to do just a goof off.
Yeah.
That's it. And we've now so Sam was the person who asked me first, do you think your dad would do Doug Loves Movies? And I said, I love Doug. I think he's hilarious. I think it's a great show. My only concern is that I'm very protective of my dad. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what to expect from Doug. Is he going to be the stoner guy who makes fun of my dad? Or what is it going to be? I don't ever want to put him in a situation that's not comfortable. So what we did was we said, okay, here's the deal. He'll go on, but Sam has to be on the show too. Because then I felt safe.
Right.
Because Sam will protect him. It'll be great. When we meet Doug, and yeah, he's high as a kite, but... The two of them were just going, and
well, it's genuine.
Oh yeah,
you know? I mean, Doug's funny, and Doug can take the piss out of anybody. But yes. his appreciation for film is genuine.
It's real. I'm always amazed.
And far reaching.
How does he see so much? I don't even understand.
He doesn't have a job.
But that's it. He's still at South by Southwest. He's seeing, you know, he's posting all these photos from the closing night film Isle of Dogs, and I'm like, you just see everything.
Yeah.
You see everything. He's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, that's what you kind of come to realize too when you, I think people get a little lost when they meet, especially when they meet comics, because they confuse their stage persona with their kind of real life. It happens to everybody. People think I'm Don Draper. It's like, couldn't be further from the truth. But people, because that's what they see and that's what they think they know. And so when they, you know, they think, oh, Doug's just like a stoner, he's a pot comic, whatever, like blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, he's a really smart dude who's really engaged in the community. And, you know, it's like, it's the same thing with people like Patton, where, you know, oh, he's like the nerd guy who just does like ha-ha funny.
No, he's so bright.
No. He's way more than that.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's, you know, to kind of put a button on all that, that's the real fun part of being a member of this community. And living out here as long as I have and making the friendships that I've made over the 20 some odd years that I've lived in LA longer than I've lived anywhere else. I think that shift just happened like a year ago. I was like, oh my God, I guess this is home now. You know, I'm from St. Louis, but like I've been out here long enough to where like I'm pretty comfortable out here. And my friends are too. They're all out here. You know, I have my old homies from way back in the day, who I'll always be friends with, but I've got a nice community out here, and that's the fun part of getting to do what I've gotten to do for as long as I've gotten to do it, is to be able to say like, oh yeah, I know that guy, he's a good guy.
Yeah,
and I find everybody knows everybody in some way. I swear,
and that's what's so nice. Connected. Obviously, like when you're right to be sort of protective of your dad and like nervous, but like. When you couldn't be in safer hands than going on stage at UCB and like talking about movies. Like
100%.
That's the best.
It's a great crowd.
Even though I think officially the worst player
of all games.
That's amazing.
There's no
real contest there.
People are always so nervous. They go, oh man, I can't go up against Leonard. It's like, oh no, you can. You definitely, you've
my
got
mind
this.
Just doesn't sort the information
you've
that way.
Got
it's,
this. You know.
It's hard. And it's hard. Yeah. You're up there and you think, oh, I got this. And as soon as you're sort of presented with the actual facts of it, you go, shit, no, I don't.
What has happened now more than once, because I've been writing for the book since I was little, is that they've been reviews that I wrote. And so I know as soon as he starts talking about something, I go, he doesn't know this because he hasn't seen that movie.
He didn't write it, yeah.
This one's mine. This is my review. And I'm sitting there just dying. But
And so it goes.
I know.
And so it goes.
But Bill Hader, I think the two of you, and he just brought you on stage
for
SNL. Yes, he
did.
I'll show you
a very funny, this is my favorite thing about doing podcasts is that you have the ability to do these things that no one will see.
Right?
So I will show you.
Just imagine at home.
Imagine
or wherever you're listening to us.
We just got to interview Bill Hader.
That was me holding up the Goodnight's cue card.
Oh, my God. That is so cute.
Wally Fairston, who's the longtime cue card guy at SNL, I was watching Goodnight's, and he looks at me. He saw me. He hands me the cue card. He goes, I was like, you know, I'm terrified to, like, do anything wrong.
Right,
I won't be invited back. But he goes, do it. Stand there. So I'm holding the cue card. And Hader starts laughing as he says goodnights, and he get up here.
Aww.
And so I got to give him a big hug, and
that's
he did
great.
Such a great job. Like I know the feeling. Like I said, you said what's the best part of it? It's like that's the best part when you say goodnight and think I'm done.
Yeah,
because it's such a crazy hectic week. So it was really nice to support my friend.
And, oh yeah,
that's wonderful. Well, you know what? We're done too.
Finally.
Apparently.
Time, yes.
Time, gentlemen, time.
Time has flown.
This was so nice. What a lovely conversation. Thank you so
just
much
great.
For having me.
Thank you so much for spending some of your precious
yes.
time.
Home time.
Rare
yeah,
time
exactly.
in Los Angeles here with us in this palatial studio.
It is gorgeous.
I know, right?
Thank you for having me. Thank you for talking about fun things with me.
You always remember my mom. And this was such a huge deal to her because she'd see you every year at the AFI mm-hmm. luncheon. Mm-hmm. Every year the AFI has 10 best TV shows, 10 best films. They put everybody in that room. And there are a lot of people, again, now as television has changed, mm-hmm. you do have more crossover.
Absolutely.
But it used to be entirely separate entities.
Oh, yeah.
And when the hell were you going to get Brad Pitt in the same room as somebody who's TV famous?
Mm-hmm.
And my mom would always come home. She'd go, John remembers me. He still remembers me. And it meant the absolute world
well,
to her.
Please give her my best.
We will
do that. We will do that. And where do people follow you, John, if they want to?
I don't have a social media presence at all.
That's why you're so happy.
I don't. I kind of made a decision early on that was not for me. So I don't know. Probably just in the neighborhood.
Yeah,
please,
great.
Please
just
don't.
Just go stalk him. Just go follow
please
him.
Please don't follow me. You know, I'm around. I do my things, and I go to my fun shows, and I'm around. I'm engaged in life. I'm not engaged in social media.
I say bully for that. I genuinely
too.
Do.
And now he's awkwardly like, how do I transition into our social media?
Because we're working it.
Well, I will say this about like Instagram. I have an account on Instagram that I follow like baby animals and
right?
spiral staircases and like shots from above things. And I do like it as a way to waste time to look at things that I find pleasant.
Yes.
That's my one thing. And it really is. I'm not kidding. I can show you. It's like the weird like Korean farm that has baby animals that like it's the weirdest thing. But it sort of makes a waiting in a airport lounge go a little faster.
Understood.
May I recommend
Understood.
Disney Pets, where it's just dogs and cats and what have you
oh
dressed
God.
Up
Sounds
as
amazing.
Disney characters.
Are you kidding me? That could be 8 hours of my life.
He's I mean,
ready.
Pretty much.
He's ready.
Pretty much.
All right, so rat us out. What
yep.
do we do?
You are at Leonard Maltin, and I am at Jesse Maltin on Instagram and Twitter, and you can always go to www.leonardmaltin.com to read movie reviews and book reviews and everything else you need that's Maltin.
Sums it up well.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And thanks again, John.
Thanks, guys.
Hope to see you soon. And be sure to look for John and Rosamund Pike in the new movie Beirut, which opens April 11th. And folks, we hope to see you here next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.